This episode of Current Geek is brought to you by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. Get $50 off select mattresses by visiting casper.com/geek and use the promo code GEEK at checkout.
Unfortunately, the Warner kids were totally out of control.
Boingy, 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 boingy.
The trio ran amok throughout the studio until their capture. The Warner's films, which made absolutely no sense, were locked away in the studio vault, never to be released. As for the Warners themselves, they were locked away in the studio water tower, also never to be released.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek! Uh-huh.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek Autopilot Edition. Chance for us to go back and watch a pilot episode of an old classic geeky show. TV usually, but you know, we may make exceptions. I guess there aren't really pilots of movies. Sometimes there are. I don't know. And we talk about how it differed from the series and became what we remember about it in general. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. And this week, we talk about the original Animaniacs. Remember that show? That was a thing in the 90s. Animaniacs, Tom.
Animaniacs. It's got 20s announcer voice. It's got throwback kind of feel. It's Looney Tunes. It's animation. It's everything Scott Johnson loves.
Well, you had me. Okay, this is going to be interesting. Anyone who listens to me on other shows probably has heard me before go a little negative on Animaniacs. Part of the reason we chose this so we could dig this out a little bit and understand why. I understand that there are generations of people, young and old, kids and adults from that time, who loved Animaniacs. It spoke to everyone. I am on board with everybody 100% on writing, on voice acting. That stuff's all fine. The stories are great. The concepts are great. The humor's good. That isn't the problem. My problem is
so you're not dead inside.
No, I'm not 100%. I'm not a dead husk inside yet. But where the part of me that is a dusty old husk of death is this part. I was so, and I mean completely and entirely obsessed with Chuck Jones and Tex Avery and those kind of early artists and animators who worked on old 1940s, 1950s. Looney Tunes and even the MGM stuff, like the original Tom and Jerry's, were amazing, and the stuff Tex Avery worked on with like Droopy and all that kind of stuff. I loved it. I have multiple books. I don't have them in reach like you always do, but I've got books in a closet over there that are just like the whole life of Tex Avery. What made him tick and why was he one of the most important animators of our time? And I got another one all about, you know, some other dude, one of the Freebergs or somebody. So I was really into this, really, really into it. And I'm a kid
in
the 80s.
You found out that Animaniacs was made with a higher cell count than most TV cartoons that made them move more fluidly. They didn't just stand still when they spoke.
Yeah, this isn't untrue what you're saying. Here's the problem. Because I was so, so much of my like for that stuff was the style and the quality of the animation and the timing of it. And all that kind of stuff. It was just like amazing.
Your love of the Looney Tunes stuff was
yes,
that.
Yes, the early stuff, right.
Yeah.
This comes along. I think it's just a product of bad timing. But this comes along in the very early 90s. We had
September 13th, 1993 on Fox.
We have not quite gotten to what would be the new generation of animation coming out of things like Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network, and other things. Part of which was spurned forward by the process of animation getting much, much cheaper and the quality of it going up regardless of the cheapening of it, because technology was there to sort of help push things along. Things that would create the ability to make it faster, cheaper, and look better than we had to deal with when we were making He-Man and other kind of garbage during the 70s and 80s. So, all of that being said, they tried harder to get out of there, but they never, ever got back to what made the 40s stuff so great. And it always looked cheap and flimsy to me. So it's purely an aesthetic, technical thing. I get way hung up on it. It kept me from enjoying it.
And it's not the technology behind it, no. Right? Because it's not the fluidity or it looks cheap as in it's low res.
Right.
You're just saying the artistry wasn't there.
The artistry was not
there. Totally subjective.
And it didn't match what I had in my head anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of what the classics were. So
And I think what people need to understand before they hurl their insults at you, which they will anyway, I guess, is you're not saying it's bad. Mm-hmm. You're saying you have a love for that text. Avery Chuck Jones style,
yeah.
And Animaniacs leaned so hard into being the heir apparent to that.
Yeah.
Especially coming off of Tiny Toon Adventures was the success that lent to Animaniacs, and Animaniacs was going to take that spirit of Chuck Jones and Tex Avery even farther, that when it didn't match up, it was a big disappointment. It sounds.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That's exactly it. It just didn't live up to that. And it tried so hard in every other way and nailed it. Like the music's there. The like I said, the writing is always there. Their ability to speak to multiple generations and not just pander to kids was there. That's how all the old stuff was as well. People always think that, you know, Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner and all that stuff was made for kids. It really wasn't. I mean, it was great for kids, but parents loved it too because it was great subversive sort of adult content, not in the way we think of it now, but you know.
And Animaniacs intentionally did that as well. Said, we want to have things that adults find funny.
And they did. And they did a great job of that. So they leaned so hard into it. They had the music. They had the general look. They had all this stuff. And they had the blessing of Warner Brothers and all of its properties to sort of help support it and have fun with it. You had Steven Spielberg and Amblin Entertainment behind the thing. You had everybody doing their very best. But at the end of the day, the budget wasn't there to animate the way they used to. So what they had to do is cut a bunch of corners, and it doesn't look great. And because of that disconnect, it's always rubbed me the wrong way. So it's out of the way up front. We can talk about the meat of this thing. And if this comes up again, we can discuss it. But I just want people to know where I stand on it. I know it's a very sensitive subject for fans of the show. I wish I shared their utter devotion to it. I am excited about the reboot coming because I actually think those things I mentioned that weren't there in 1992-93 in terms of technology and its, you know, kind of where we were with animation, we're in a whole new place now. We can go all kinds of crazy and have it look right. Someone in the chat asked, Scott, do I like Rocky and Bullwinkle? Do I like, they mentioned a bunch of other sort of stiffer animation. Beavis and Butthead was mentioned. Yes, I do, because the style of those matches the content. It's kind of like XKCD. That's a comic with stick people in it. And it's perfect. Well, why? You can sit and complain about, oh, the art isn't very good. That's not a problem. The art matches the sense of humor and it works perfectly. The problem with this and the Animaniacs in general is if you're going to approach this, you approach it with as much homage as possible so that it works the best, and they missed the technical end and the artistry end.
And when you say technical end, I think that can be confusing to people because I don't think you're saying it was lower resolution or not as fluid, or, you know, like the animation technology is better in Animaniacs than most things from 1993.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what you're saying is that they lacked frame rate.
No, frame rate wasn't a problem.
I think what you're saying is the artistry of it, the way they drew it, didn't work for you.
Right.
Is
like
that right?
Like when you had He-Man, one of the big complaints and one of the things that actually makes He-Man great in a bad kind of great way is that they would reuse animation over and over and over. They do a couple of rotoscope shots and then some really cheap standing stuff. And then they would interchange that and use it constantly. And that was true of a lot of 80s cartoons then. We all look back on that fondly now and kind of laugh at it. But they did that to save money and cut corners. And that also saved a bunch of time. They didn't do any of those kinds of corner cutting in that regard. Where they cut corners was voices matching up with the movement, gestures that don't go with the scenes. Very discordant for me. And it's only because if this existed in a vacuum, was the only time we'd ever seen this, I'd be stoked. But because I watch it, it feels like something's off the whole time because it doesn't match the source material that they're paying homage
to. I think that's really interesting because it's almost as if they had gone with a 1940s era technology, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have had the ability to make the mistakes that stick out to you, right?
Yeah.
They would have had to just stand still while they talked, and then you wouldn't feel like, oh, well, that gesture was weird. That didn't really match up. Where'd that come from, right?
Right.
It gave them room to make mistakes.
It's almost like they moved around too much. Mm-hmm. And that's a weird because thing to say, maybe, because back in the 40s, they did it the old-fashioned way, and it was the long, arduous way, and you really grinded out your time when you were an animator in the 40s. But your work was pretty awesome because there was so much focus and artistry and like completeness to everything that they did. But like Chuck Jones, one of the great things about his style is his characters, let's say we'll use, you know, the Daffy Duck, any one of the, like Duck Season. That's a great, everyone remembers Duck Season, Rabbit Season. There are moments where it's funny because Daffy Duck is holding perfectly still, except his bill is flipping around his head really fast because he's got shot in the face. It's knowing when to freeze frame things, knowing when to have more fluidity. Some of the shortcuts they use to create speed or depth or that kind of stuff were really inventive for the time. In 1992, they could do all of that. It's not like they couldn't do it. I just don't know why they didn't. Like, they just didn't have the restraint, or they didn't have the right people in charge directing or something. I don't know, but it's always driven me up a tree. And it makes you feel slightly bad because, again, it's a fun, great thing, and it was really great for its time. And to get back to my point, I'm more excited about the reboot because I think we've just learned a lot since then. It's less of a, hey, it's the 90s, what can we do? It's more of a, all right, we really know what animation is doing right now. We're in a bit of a resurgence. There's stuff across all these platforms and, you know, stuff popping up on streaming services that are animated shows just for that service. And, you know, it's never been a better time, really, to have a cool animated project to do. So to me, here's your chance to really show us what you got. Take us back to that time. Still make it modern and funny, but just tune it up. That's all. Just tune it up.
Now, let's go back to a point you made earlier for people who are not yet angrily throwing their phone down, but steaming. that seems like we're trashing Animaniacs. Because, by the way, I love Animaniacs. Yeah. I don't agree with Scott at all because I got 10 eyes. I can't see any of this stuff he's talking about, so it doesn't bother me, luckily for me.
Right.
But you thought it was funny.
It was great. Yeah, no, I totally enjoyed it. Yeah. There are a couple of lines in here that I actually chuckled out loud. I think it probably even got better from here. I don't remember a lot of episodes post this because, again, it drove me nuts back in the day, but there's plenty here to like. I mean, it's funny. We don't even get Pinky and the Brain yet. We get sightings
of them. No, they get the briefest of appearances, right?
Yeah, just they're there for a hot second. Sure. Yeah. And you get a little You get a taste of the Brain's awesome...
taste of the Brain.
Burr voice that he has, that kind of fake William Burr thing. And it's great. And all that stuff's great. And the interaction between, like, the birds is cracking me up.
Oh, the Goodfellas,
The Goodfellas. It's a riff on Goodfellas, which was huge back then, but, you know, absolutely an adult theme that kids wouldn't totally understand, but it didn't matter. And that's great. But then when they start moving, I go, oh, you guys, with your corner cutting and you're hoping this looks okay attitude. It's just hard for me. And I admit it makes me seem like a weird little purist, little picky little bumhole that I'm being about it, but I can't.
You are so effete. Everyone knows it, Scott.
Yeah, Orson Welles.
You only like the finest things in life.
They're saying Orson Welles in the chat, not William Burr. They're right. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. That's true.
I did mean that. But anyway.
We did watch Citizen Kane on Current Geek recently. We should know this.
And these are, you know, some of these actors went on to do really cool stuff. Dot Warner is played by Tress McNeil, or Neil, I guess is how you say it. But anyway, mm-hmm. She's famous for everything you've ever seen that's animated. I guarantee she's had some role in it. She's been in The Simpsons. She's Seymour Skinner's mother, for example. That old lady voice you hear her do in a lot of shows. She shows up as, I can't remember the name of the characters, but she's in Futurama. She's in all kinds of stuff. And it's like across the board, Frank Welker's in there. He plays the guard that won't let anybody in. Becomes kind of a butt of a joke, you know, over different episodes and stuff. Like, these are... season.
I mean, Jim Cummings shows up in the first episode. I'd forgotten that. Yeah. You get the second voice of Winnie the Pooh.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing his Winnie the Pooh voice. It's not, I mean, Jim Cummings can do a lot of different voices. He's most famous for being the person who picked up, you know, the Winnie the Pooh voice without missing a beat. But he does that voice with the Good Night, not Good Night Moon, but Good Night Animaniacs.
And it was a great, I don't know, that was a great moment. Here's a piece of it. I captured some of that.
Nighty-night people everywhere.
And nighty-night wackos underwear.
That's pretty much... pretty much the jokes, you know, like they're all a lot of rhymes and funny little things. There's the interview between the doctor and the, and not Wacko, but the other one.
Jacko
or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's the one that sounds like a Beatle. And
yeah, he actually did a John Lennon impression in his audition.
Mm-hmm.
And they liked it so much. They're like, yes, make that Yakko's voice. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. It fits.
I always thought he was doing Ringo. And right. Turned out he was doing John.
To me, that accent is Ringo. So I know what you're saying, but you're right. It's like all the Beatles. But anyway, that little interview they have back and forth where he's trying to do name association or word association is brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's so well written.
Iconic timing is just so sophisticated.
If I close my eyes, it's amazing. I open them and I go.
Your thing is you need to listen to Animaniacs.
Maybe that's
watching.
The trick. Put it onto the background. Let it be funny on its own because it is funny. And I feel bad that I have this thing with it, this hang up, you know?
I mean, you shouldn't feel bad. It's not like you're making it up. That's what makes somebody snooty. Is when they were like, you could get over this if you wanted to. You just want to appear better than people. That's not what's going on with you. You're like, no, I want to not see this stuff. I want to not have this stuff bother you, but it just does.
Yeah, and from a character design perspective, which is another dimension of what I'm talking about, it's dead on. Like these character designs, these three new characters inserted into the long history of Looney Tunes animation and Warner Brothers animation are brilliantly done. They're so, on the one hand, original. On the other hand, very reminiscent of like, it's almost like it's making fun of Mickey Mouse in that whole era. They look like, you know, old Felix the Cat.
They look like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah,
they
do.
With longer ears,
they
right?
They do. They totally do. And it's
wait, what was the first character, the first Disney character that they lost control of for the longest time? It kind of looks like him too.
Steamboat Willie. No, not Steamboat Willie.
No, before Steamboat Willie.
It was before that, right? And he wasn't a mouse. He was a... Was he a cat?
Like a rabbit or something, I think.
Or a rabbit. He was a rabbit. Wally?
Oswald.
I knew it.
They look like Oswald.
Yeah, they totally do. They're all from that kind of Betty Boop era kind of style. You know, lots of blacks, heavy blacks and whites and red noses and that. And the big gloves and the skinny legs and arms. And they're really good. Like, genuinely good. And so are all the other character designs. That isn't the problem. It's when they start moving. That's all. Which is the point. It's an animated show. They animate.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a problem if you don't like the way they move.
Right. So
I think you should just listen to the old Animaniacs and rekindle your love for Wacko, Yakko, and Dot.
The entire series and I think the standalone movie, although I can't say that for sure. I meant to look that up. They have a little standalone direct-to-DVD thing that was supposed to be in theaters. It didn't. I would actually like to see that to see. Sometimes they up your game for that kind of thing because it's going to theaters. So
Wacko's Wish is the name of the movie.
Yeah, maybe that animation improves. But anyway, all of that stuff's on Hulu now.
Yep.
And Hulu's getting the new series, right? So
yep.
Yeah. So welcome to the world of
and
streaming.
And it is Steven Spielberg. We haven't really talked much about the construction of this, but it was Spielberg as executive producer and Paul. I almost said Paul Rudd.
Ant-Man films Ant-Man.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Tom Ruger and Paul Rugg. Mm. Paul Rugg, I think was the one I was thinking of there. But the producers were, Rich Ahrens, Sherry Stoner, Rusty Mills, and Peter Hastings. But I think, wasn't it Rugg? Was it Rugg or
Ruger? Tom Ruger. Isn't he the creator?
Ruger is the one who was the showrunner basically.
Right.
He's not coming back. Spielberg's coming back to do the Hulu one. Amblin Entertainment is producing it, but it's a different team.
Right.
And they haven't announced any voices yet either. I'm sure they're trying to get the originals to do it if they can. And that takes a while to work out contracts and schedules and all of that.
Sure.
But I wonder, without the same writing team, without the same showrunner, if it's going to maintain the same sensibility. It can. You know, it's not impossible, but it's harder.
It's a lot harder. I want that writing team to maintain. It sounds like.
And it's honestly, Tom Ruger might not be as good at doing this anymore either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He's, let's see, born in 54, you know, guys.
He's still working, but he's working, I think, over at another studio, which is why. Yeah. He's working at Disney.
Yeah. Because he stopped Animaniacs. Last thing he did was 99 with the Wacko's Wish. And then.
He started Tom Ruger production after that.
Yeah.
They worked on Animalia. They worked on Sushi Pack. I didn't see either one of those, but maybe you did.
I have.
Began working for Disney Animation and Disney Junior, where he did 40 half hour shows of the 7D.
Never heard of
based
that.
On the Seven Dwarfs.
Don't know what. Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah.
Oh, and Sneezing
new,
Time.
New animated series for Disney Junior in the works. So Tom Ruger's doing his Tom Ruger thing, which is very different than Animaniacs. And so even if you could get him back, he might not be the best person to recapture that original spirit either.
Yeah. I like this new one he's working on. It's supposed to be this year, or maybe it's already coming out or it's airing somewhere, but it's called Pinky Malinky. It's funny it's got Pinky in there, but it's got that nothing
sounds,
to do with Pinky.
Yeah, that sounds Animaniac-y.
It says, this fly-on-the-wall reality show follows the life of Pinky, an infectiously positive hot dog living in the human world. All right.
Really? He named it Pinky.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Pinky's Hot Dogs is a big chain here in L.A., so I'm sure that's part of it.
Now, Pinky and the Brain, while spawned in this show, doesn't it get its own...
Yeah, they spun that out as its own. In fact, the Animaniacs history through the 90s is kind of fraught because it appealed to adults so well that it sometimes didn't get the children viewers that it needed to sell ads.
Mm.
So it started on Fox Kids,
right,
which was a segment of just the broadcast Fox channel. And it was there for a few years before it moved over to the WB. And it was on the WB that it basically struggled. You'd think, oh, once it got home, it should have got all the money it needed. But it was expensive to produce. Steven Spielberg insisted on orchestration, which no animated show got orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
And so the music made it expensive to produce. They had this high sell count that they were spending money on, exporting animation to multiple visual effects houses.
Mm-hmm.
And so the WB kept reducing the orders and just rerunning until they finally canceled not only the show, but made the movie go direct to DVD. And it's a great example of popularity does not equal success in television.
Mm-hmm.
If you're selling a show to advertisers, the advertisers, A, want to feel like it's brand appropriate. This is something I learned at Tech TV. Doesn't matter. You got all the ratings in the world. If the advertisers are like, yeah, but we don't want to be associated with that brand.
Right.
And B, you got to hit the right demo. So if it's on Fox Kids, and the advertiser comes in and says, ooh, that's a big rating. How is it with the, you know, with the 8-year-olds? And you're like, oh, no 8-year-olds watching. It's all 45-year-old men. Like, well, we're not spending toy advertising money on this. And then you're not selling daytime kids programming to adult advertisers, right? So it's just, it's a mismatch.
It is. It's interesting, too, though, the format they took. I didn't pick up on that thing about Spielberg requiring orchestrated music. I think that's really to his credit, and it's a smart thing for the show. It also contributes to my discordia with it a little bit because it's so good. Like, it's dead perfect. It's what they used to do back in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. Every episode had at least one original score.
Yeah. And it was so well done.
That's a lot of money.
Movement and stuff would be timed with the score, and that's tricky. And a lot of, like you said, it costs a bunch of money. And they do that here, and it's to their credit. But again, it adds up again to this thing that starts to be like every other piece of this puzzle's here except for where they move around. Okay, all that being said, the other weird thing about this that I completely forgot about, it's not just a quick little 15-minute drawn-out cartoon, at least not this pilot. It's a origin story for the characters and this subplot thing with the doctor. Then you got that monkey song thing.
Right.
And then you got that little tune at the end. Like, all of that caught me off guard. I didn't expect a three-parter, basically.
It was always three basically unrelated sketches.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
It really had a sketch comedy feel to it because they never put a time limit on it. They just said, we need to fill our 22 minutes with three things, and they don't have to be related.
Right. The monkey.
And so it's less jarring later on because you get an Animaniac sketch, then you get a Slappy the Squirrel sketch, then you get Pinky and the Brain, and they feel like they're not supposed to be related. Whereas this first episode, you're kind of like, oh, I'm going to watch the Animaniacs, and you get an origin story. You're like, what happens to them next? Well, I guess what happens next is they sing a song. Well, that's weird.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that song is great. It's brilliant. It's really funny. It's well-written.
That's a Harry Belafonte song from the 60s.
Oh, is it? I had no idea.
Yeah, repurposed.
Yeah, it's
really
good.
They tweak the language to fit Animaniacs.
Yeah. And then the nightly tune thing was great. Like everything, like that was weird. like describing the everybody settling down inside of the big water tank, which I assume would just be like some dumb prison thing where there was, you know, like the Phantom Zone for cartoon characters. But no, it's like this cool pad with like a log flume in it and lots of great rhyming in there. And
yeah,
it's amazing.
99 tune.
Yeah, it's not. It's actually genuinely really good. In every way.
You sound so upset at having to admit it.
It's because that one piece is, it's just that close to perfection. Like, just this close. And a lot of people are like, Scott, we get it, but that's okay for us. We are willing to let that little bit go. And for me, I've just made it an obstacle, and it's unfortunate. I think what I'm going to probably do, and I say this a lot on our autopilot episodes, I'm going to go back through this thing. And I'm going to watch
it. The second episode, I started watching the second episode, has the world song.
Yeah.
Where Wacko sings the countries to the Mexican hat dance tune.
And that's
become
one
of the most enduring, beloved pieces from Animaniacs. And it's in the second episode. Whereas I like you, watch this first episode. I'm like, wow. This is not Animaniacs at its best.
Right.
You know, like, you get an origin story and not much else. Yeah, the monkey song's okay. 99 Tune's cute. But I'm like, this is not what made Animaniacs great. You see elements of what made it great in some of the jokes, right?
Yeah.
And Hello Nurse is there right from the start.
Immediately.
Which, by the way, is an old vaudevillian thing.
Yeah.
I could have sworn they used it in Looney Tunes, and maybe I just couldn't, but I could not find a reference to it in Looney Tunes. I could only find references to it from vaudeville days and Animaniacs.
Yeah.
So,
which again, anyway. To their credit, they dip so far back and they pull out stuff that kids in the 90s didn't know anything about. You know, they knew that that Looney Tunes kind of had some similar thematic stuff going on, but
it is culturally discordant. Some of the references, some of the things that they reference in here,
right.
You know, right from the start, Bill Clinton plays the sax.
Yeah.
Like that was 1993. Like, he would just become president. Like, this was a hip, super hip reference in September of 1993.
Yeah.
Now it's, they feel like, that guy, he was president back then. Yeah. Didn't his wife run for president? She got beat or something. I don't know.
We didn't know about his sexy time problems or any of that stuff. It was still just Bill Clinton played sax on Arsenio Hall show.
And they made
show.
Some other of the moment references that are to things that I'm like, oh yeah, that was really popular back then.
Yeah. Now the other reason I should like this more than I do, and I do like it, is that it's original. While it pulls from a lot of old stuff and it has cameos, you know, Porky Pig's in the first part of this fumble around. It's not just redoing those characters. It's got this whole new thing to do and tell in that world. And I appreciate it for that. That's why I would never and couldn't stand Tiny Toons. Tiny Toons had the same animation problem for me. So that's a different issue. Actually, most shows in the early 90s had this problem for me. But the big thing I didn't like about Tiny Toons is that they were saying, what if Bugs Bunny and all his friends were little baby versions of the thing? I hated that. That sucked. And there are going to be people who are mad at me now for that, but I do not like Tiny Toons at all. But at least in this case, you know, Animaniacs was like, hey, what about three new characters? What if we do all these crazy new situations? What if they're kind of a giant menace now to the campus that is the Warner Brothers Studios? And what happens then? Like, that's great. More of that is what I like. Just make it look better. That's all. Okay. Need to take a second and talk about our friends over at Casper. Casper.com, you know them, they're a sleep brand, and they continue to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. Casper's mattresses are designed by humans for humans. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface that's just the right sink and just the right bounce. And the breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulate your body temperature throughout the night. They are not just any mattress company. Casper offers a wide array of products to ensure an overall better sleep experience. Casper mattresses are made right here in the USA. Buying it is easy. Order online, delivered to your door in a compact box, and free shipping and free returns in the US and Canada. Now, here's what you got to do. You take the risk-free 100-day trial. We spend a third of our lives on a mattress, so it's pretty important you truly get to sleep on one before committing to it. That's why Casper gives you 100 nights to try it out. I love mine. It only took me about 3 days, and I was like, I'm in, we're keeping it, and we kept it, and I still sleep on it now, and I love it. You will too. Get $50 toward select mattresses by visiting casper.com/geek and use that promo code GEEK at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's $50 toward select mattresses by visiting casper.com/geek and use the promo code GEEK at checkout.
I still can't get over the fact that this show sticks in our culture still. And it, you know, in a world where Full House and Roseanne and everything's getting a reboot, I don't know, back if you'd asked me back in the 90s if I would have thought, oh yeah, Animaniacs, that'll come back. Like Roseanne, yeah, it was huge. Yeah. Like if they bring something back, remember we had the reunion shows in the 80s. They brought back Gilligan's Island, the Brady Bunch, you know, they, so it's not new to have these reboots. It's, what's new is that they have the money to actually do a whole new series instead of just a special.
Right.
And if you had said like, well, what's going to get that treatment? I don't know that I would have picked Animaniacs. Animaniacs was the thing I watched when I was working at Half Price Books. And I didn't have to go until 2 o'clock, you know, and I was, and I had the TV on and I thought, well, that's hilarious. Like I discovered it in the middle of the day in my spare time by word of mouth. Now I know there was a news group on Usenet for Animaniacs. So it, they had an internet fan base well before most other things, but I didn't even find out about it there. I mean, we had this woman, Stephanie, that worked at the bookstore that my friend Sandy called Slappy because she just acted like Slappy the Squirrel to the point where we all just called her Slappy. We forgot her name was Stephanie. And it just caught on because she was so much like that character. I mean, it really does bring me back to that era of my life to watch this show, because even though I didn't watch it a lot, it's just wove its way in to the culture.
Well, part of it too is competing with this stuff in a less mainstream way was like, for me anyway, were things like Ren and Stimpy, which to me was the true heir to sort of the Tex Avery approach. And it didn't have that discordant disconnect. It was a little weird and out there, but it felt like it was true to the medium. And I felt like that was the start of something special. And I think that was kind of an opening point for a lot of those, I don't want to call them indie, but this sort of the smaller side things that you would find super interesting now, like Regular Show or, and I love a lot of modern animated shows, Steven Universe and stuff like that.
You know who else likes those kind of things? Your mom.
Ah, my mom.
Oh, wait,
likes
my
them.
Mom.
Oh, your
now
mom.
I got it wrong.
Oh.
Now I lost my Regular Show cred. Damn it.
I love that thing. So, you know, things like that, I think, owe a lot to Ren and Stimpy, but I don't know how much they really owe to Animaniacs. And maybe I just don't give enough credit.
Animaniacs did not impact other animation, I feel like.
Right.
You may be right about that. Animaniacs, however, it's one of those things, again, where you go watch it and you're like, oh, right, that's where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there are parts of that show that still just pop up into my head sometimes. And I forget that that's where it came from.
Right. And this,
anytime someone says it's time for, I pretty much begin get the Animaniacs tune cut in my head.
Now, there's a couple of people in the chat bringing up a couple of things that I should clarify. I thought in my head, I'm probably conflating them, but there was a Looney Tunes babies thing, and then there was Tiny Toons, which was like young rabbits and ducks and stuff, but their parents were teachers at the school. So like Bugs Bunny was a teacher or something. I probably conflated those two shows. I still think they're poop. So that's the main thing that I wanted to address there. Somebody said here, where was it? Now I lost it because the chat, you guys are chatty tonight. Here we go. It says, too bad we can't watch Ren and Stimpy anymore without remembering John Kay as a pedo POS. Yeah, there's been some stuff recently. I just want to put it out there that separate the art from the artist a little bit. Ren and Stimpy was really, really groundbreaking at the time for what it was and what it would inspire. And we have, I think we're in a renaissance period, an embarrassment of riches period right now for animation of all kinds, whether it be anime and things that come from other cultures, other influences, and homegrown stuff right here, things that get subbed out to Korea, whatever it may be, it's all great. And we are living in the best possible time to consume it all. We get the old stuff, there's new stuff coming, there's reboots happening. We don't cringe at reboots the way we used to. I don't know if you remember this or not, Tom, but there was a time when Tom and Jerry was sacrosanct, and the minute somebody in the 80s would go, we're rebooting a new Tom and Jerry thing, and guess what? The cat and the mouse talk to each other. Freaking F that noise, dude. That
I remember hating that.
It's the worst.
I didn't mind that they were bringing back Tom and Jerry. I hated that they were going to give them voices.
Right.
Like, that's what made the cartoon so compelling was that they told the story and you didn't even realize they weren't talking to each other.
It's a complete lack of respect for your source material and the stuff that made it great. And it's just you going, well, what if this time, like, it's just bad planning, bad meetings happened, the wrong people made decisions. And that happened a lot. We now live in a time where I feel like people are adhering closer to what made their stuff great. And I have really high hopes and good, I think, strong expectations for what a reboot of this series could be like. The new Disney Mickey Mouse shorts that they started doing, super cool. Like, very close in terms of tone to their original shorts that they did over at Disney, but have these great modern kind of edge to everything. It's great. Like, this is the right time for this. So all of my poo-pooing, I think, gets rectified when this comes out. Do we know when this comes out? When do we get this?
No, they've just said 2020, I think.
That's a bummer, because I'd like to see it sooner than that.
Yeah, well, they just announced this year they're going to do it. So they're ramping up the thing. They haven't even cast the folks who are going to do the show or anything like that. But according to IndieWire, in May 2017, they were in the early stages of developing a reboot. So they've only been working on it for a little while.
So Kilmanarok 1285 says something in the chat that I meant to ask you. Where are you at with Space Jam? Because there are a lot of 90s kids that will claim Space Jam was the best movie released in the 90s. So how'd you feel about Space Jam? Which was kind of like, you know, hey, remember Roger Rabbit? We finally figured out how to do that right. So here's Michael Jordan playing with a bunch of Looney Tunes characters.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think at the time of that?
Well, Scott, you've put me in a position that I've never been in before.
Oh!
And I'm going to have to reveal something that I've never been able to admit.
Yeah?
I've never seen Space Jam.
Oh, you should see Space Jam. Space Jam's awesome. It's got Bill Murray is in Space Jam. Not for very
I've
much.
I've seen the trailer.
Yeah? All right. It's also famous because spacejam.com.
I know what it's about.
Is it spacejam.com? Yeah. Spacejam.com is still up, and they haven't changed it. It's the same crappy website. You got to go look at it. It's great. It's so 90s, it hurts.
1996.
Yeah, dude. That was
1996. Great. 1996. I was starting Sabrilliant.com. I was working at Half Price Books. I was creating a television show for Austin Access Television. I was not watching Space Jam.
I was getting ready to have my daughter, who was going to be
I was 26 years old.
Yeah, so was I. It's such a weird thing. But anyway, they still have that site up, and it's great. But Space Jam, so this may surprise people. I love Space Jam. I think Space Jam's proof that you can take this stuff and make it new again. And they did. They did a great job. But they also had a giant, movie-sized budget for that thing. And I don't think they had that kind of, they had a good budget for animation, but I don't think they had the same kind of budget.
The more I heard you talk about it at the beginning of the show, the less I thought it was about budget. Everything I've read is that Animaniacs had a pretty big budget. And that's one of the problems. It's why it didn't stick around longer, is they couldn't afford to make the new episodes. It's about implementation.
Right.
You just didn't like the way they implemented it.
Right. And I just think that you could do today.
I just wonder if it's a workflow issue.
Right. That's what I'm getting
at. In some
way. That's what I'm getting at. Because I think that is what it is. You could do it today. You could do what they made in the 90s today with way cheaper tools and maybe not manpower. Maybe that's more because, you know, inflation and everything. So you'd pay more for people to do the actual work.
Oh, 2020, by the way. It's Animaniacs reboot starts in 2020.
That's a ways off.
Yeah. Well, everything's coming in 2020, though. We get self-driving cars. The blockchain finally works. Internet of Things will be mature.
Don't you feel like if there's ever a year we actually get the singularity, don't you think 2020's got a pretty good shot?
2020 singularities for sure.
Yeah, it feels like it. Like,
just don't die before 2020. You'll be fine.
Chat room suggests you should watch Space Jam this week. I think you should.
I mean, Space Jam's I should do great. A lot of things this week.
It's got Charles Barkley in it. It's got all these like big time NBA stars at the time in it.
I should watch Space Jam. Yeah. I don't feel like I'm proud of the fact that I haven't seen it. I feel like I'm missing out on certain aspects of culture And I don't know, where is it on our current Geek Film?
I don't know. I would watch it again for this. That's a great idea. It's not in the top 100, I don't think. Though.
I don't know if it's in the top 228.
Probably not, but
it might not be.
It deserves to be on another list, which is just fun things I saw in the 1990s, because it's pretty great. And
we did figure out, by the way, side note here, All About Eve, neither Scott or I have seen.
No. So we're going to, that's a fresh hot bun out of
that.
Yeah,
he thought he had seen it because we were thinking it was the Four Faces of Eve.
Or yeah, was it four or three? Three Faces of Eve. That's what it is. You gave her an extra face.
Eve had a lot of faces. I don't remember.
What's one extra face? It's fine.
Even all the faces, too many faces to count.
That's true. Now, in the 90s, of all of the animated things that were sort of on display, because I started relatively young having my kids, so like by the time, let's see, when was this, 92, 93?
96. Animaniacs,
93. Here's when it premiered. I was still a year away from my first kid, but as soon as I had her and she started to come of an age where cartoons would sort of pop for her and she'd be like, ooh, and she'd want to watch them, my consumption of whatever was being produced at that time went way up because she was into it. So we would watch everything that were on these relatively fledgling networks like Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network and other stuff. That would be it all day, like that and a little Barney, because Barney was bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just constant intake of these things. And I have so much fond feelings for that entire period from various sources, all kinds of different shows. I hear about them now and I go, oh, we should go watch that. Even something dumb like Rugrats, I thought was great at the time. And throughout all of that, you had that big catalog of all these things to watch. This one was never a priority. And I don't know why, because I'm sure she would have liked it or enjoyed it, but we just were like, meh, it's something else. We'll watch something else. It was never this. So again, yeah. I don't know why. Again, Scott's got this weird hangup. Can't figure it out. You'd think I wouldn't care if my daughter wanted to watch it, but anyway, that's how that went.
Well, it's a weird history, too. Just being able to find it to watch.
Yeah.
Season one was 65 episodes. Jeez. They made a 65-episode order in 1993 and ran it until May of 1994 mm-hmm. on Fox Kids segment. It's always listed as the network being Fox Kids, but it was just Fox. They just called the kids programming Fox Kids on the regular Fox.
Yeah.
Then they could only afford four more episodes for season two. So it went from 65 episodes to four episodes, and then they just kind of reran it with those four new episodes through the rest of 94. They did a theatrical short called I'm Mad,
yep.
which opened in front of Thumbelina in 1994. And they planned to do a bunch more of those. They were going to like, this is going to be the new thing. We're going to have Animaniacs shorts before movies, just like you used to watch Bugs Bunny shorts before movies. That was it. They never did another one after I'm Mad.
That's too bad. That's a
and
fun
then
Pixar
Animaniacs. Though. Fox was like, too expensive, we can't do it. So the WB took it over and put it on their kids block. So they started with 13 episodes in 95, ran those through 96, and then they started doing the same thing. Like, well, maybe take some work you already did and make us some new episodes. So season four is 8 episodes and season 5 is 9 episodes. And then of course Wacko's Wish came out in 1999. They never made an episode of Animaniacs or a movie or any new Animaniacs content in the 21st century.
Wow. That's weird to think, isn't it? A little bit.
Yeah.
But here it is coming, 2020, year of the singularity. We're going to finally get more of that stuff. But that's interesting because, I don't know, obviously it was popular enough that it has this huge following now. But like you said earlier, it's just not enough to justify a longer lifespan than that. You know?
I mean, it's funny. Bugs Bunny succeeded because kids and parents were always going to see it together.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it survived a lot. Pretty much by being shown in theaters before other movies.
Yeah, that's what they were. Those were this thing, this 5-minute bumper, basically.
And I feel like Animaniacs was like, let's do that too, except the business model didn't support it. And then we're like, we'll also be in theaters. And theaters were like, we don't need that. We don't need to pay for that either.
Yeah.
So it was just a victim of a really good idea not having anyone who could find the right place for it.
Well, I'm glad.
And like you said earlier, today there's no end of, Adult Swim mm-hmm. or this or that, there's no end of places for it to be.
No, that's everywhere.
But it was in some ways way ahead of its time.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Also, I'm glad you brought up the sort of when cartoons were bumpers before movies, that was huge in the 40s and some of the 50s, but it kind of died off for a long time. And it's not the first time we've seen somebody try to rejuvenate that. It happened with the aforementioned Roger Rabbit. They had mm-hmm. a couple of Roger Rabbit shorts that would show up before films. They were pretty funny and well-made, and they were set in the Roger Rabbit universe, not with live action, so they were trying to do a more traditional cartoon with it, and I thought they were great. They didn't last. I wasn't sure why. It wasn't until really Pixar brought this back, this idea back, but they had to do it themselves. It's like, all right, we're going to do shorts.
They ruined it with Frozen.
We're going to do shorts, and we're going to put them in front of our movies. And now every animated movie studio likes to do shorts. So if you're going to go see a Sony Pictures production, I can't remember, the Sony Animation Studios production, you're going to watch that little squirrel from Ice Age do a five-minute cartoon. If you go now to even just mainstream Disney animated films, they're also now doing Pixar-like shorts before them. And they're kind of almost the same companies now, so it's hard to say who's doing what, but it, they had to bring it back.
Only
but,
on Coco did they regret it and actually pull it from the theater.
Right. But isn't it funny that now it's like if you want to get an animated short, you either go to an animated short festival, which I used to do all the time when I was younger, or you are going to see a feature-length animated film that might have a five-minute short in front of it. No more will you go to, I don't know, John Wick 3 and see something before it, except trailers. That's what it is now, is trailers.
Well, Fastidious points out that the cartoon shorts in the theaters were for Sunday matinees for kids.
Right.
So it was showings. So you probably wouldn't show John Wick, certainly not in the 40s, as a Sunday matinee for kids.
Right.
So it was always movies that were going to be family appropriate that they showed those before. And TV's Egon even logged onto his phone just to comment. But he said the 2014 reboot of Tom and Jerry from the Cartoon Network is quite good. They don't talk. And it's a good successor to the original show.
Oh,
shorts.
I should check that out. I didn't know that was even a thing.
Thank you, TV's Econ.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I think that's, like I said, I think that stuff can be done right. It just has to be the right people doing it. What was I going to say? Oh, the other reason they would do these, one of these books I have talks about this, is that cartoons, the cartoon shorts, five-minute shorts back in the old days, were some of the earliest colorized stuff you could see. So if you had a movie with, I don't know, some serious movie coming out, or I guess it could be a comedy, but it didn't matter. Those were still feature length black and white in a lot of cases, but the 5-minute cartoon ahead of it would be full color. And that would just be like, ooh, a new movie technology, and we can see it for 5 minutes, but then we'll go back to this other thing. It's almost like, movies that have 3D in them, but only a little bit, or I don't know, like a little tease or whatever.
We're gonna show you virtual 3 dimensions.
And now I think
they used to do demos like that before in the what's that at AMC theaters? They have Nuvi, hosted mm-hmm. by Maria Menounos. Mm-hmm. That's the new theatrical short.
And she's
they show you promo videos for television shows.
The only thing I don't like about her is it feels like they're filming her in Tron World. It's just very cold and desolate.
Well, she's not real. No, she's totally real.
She's totally real. Good. She's a real person. I can sleep better now.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. That's what we've heard anyway.
Not a simulation. There's no truth to the rumor that Maria Menounos is entirely simulated.
Despite my misgivings that are, again, purely picky and weird, I think people should go and consume this again. I think that there's something there. I laughed out loud a couple of times. Did not expect to. Thought I was going to be too cynical for it. Caught me funny. I think I'm going to watch them again. Like, I'm going to go through and watch them. And this time I'm going to watch them with a more mature attitude about what made this show great, and maybe try to get off my horse a little bit on the animation thing.
Well, I think it's fair to say I still don't like the things I don't like, mm-hmm. while giving, good credit to the things that you do like. There's nothing wrong with that.
I agree. And in because I'm going to do that, because I've shown such benevolence toward this, I think Tom...
In your kindness.
I think Tom should be forced to watch Space Jam. That's what I think. Or maybe...
Yeah, I think that's entirely fair.
It's fair. And I think you'd actually really quite enjoy it. It's a good time.
Yeah, I don't have anything against Space Jam. It is a...
Just didn't get to it, sure.
Something I need to take care of.
And I have lots of movies like that. I have movies this year that you'd think Scott has already should have seen 2-3 times already. I haven't seen Deadpool 2 yet. I haven't seen Ant-Man and the Wasp. There's like a whole handful of things that have come out this summer that I've just missed.
I never saw Game Night.
I haven't seen Game Night either. And I hear Game Night's so up our alley. It should hurt.
Amazing.
We should feel it up our alley. It's so far up there. That's what I've heard.
I heard that we actually get mail at it because it's so far in our alley.
Well, that explains some missing packages.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. And also, I would watch an animated John Wick movie, Aurora.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my Lord.
So they're doing promos where my wife works for a show they're doing. I don't think they're out until next week, but they're hilarious.
Mm.
And one of them has to do with it. One of the shticks in the promos are about, you know, people saying things that you don't agree with, right?
Yeah.
And one of them says, John Wick is funny. All that about a dog? I'm like, that's horrible. That as a horrible. Dog owner, that's horrible. That it really horrible. Made me laugh.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen John Wick, it'll make sense when you see it.
Yeah.
It's not really a spoiler until you see it, so it's fine. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode. Again, Hulu is where to get it if you want to go watch it. Big fan of Hulu in general lately, so why not?
Yeah, and they'll have it for a while since they're handling the reboot, so I think they tightened up the rights. It's not going to, like, you get halfway through watching and then goes away. So.
Yeah, and another, just a quick props to Hulu. They've got a ton of anime. They have a ton of other, like, their animated content is up the wazoo, way more than, well, I shouldn't say more than, but.
Is it up your alley?
It's up my alley, way up there.
Is your wazoo and the alley the same place?
I don't know. My dad used to say wazoo all the time.
Yeah, no, I just realized that I don't know if my wazoo is co-located with my alley.
It's adjacent to your alley.
Is it?
I don't know.
It's alley adjacent.
Yes, my wazoo is alley adjacent. There's your title, everybody. Submit that one. That's a good one. Anyway, and then Space Jam. Tom will watch that too.
One of these days.
Next month, we are going to do the Larry Sanders Show for our autopilot episode. I haven't seen the Larry Sanders Show in a while, but I loved it when it aired. We had HBO then.
And I'll be honest, I don't know if I ever saw the first episode of the Larry Sanders Show.
I couldn't.
I know I saw plenty of them, but I can't say for sure that I watched episode one.
Yeah, they all bleed together for me, but it's the first time I ever saw Jeffrey Tambor. It's the first time I really knew who Rip Torn was. I think that Gary Shandling is a national treasure, and it's horrible that he died as early as he did. So yeah, I'm actually looking forward to this one. I think this should be fun to see that. And for those who don't know, it was like this kind of great, maybe the original, like, comedies up to that point, they all had laugh tracks. Everything did. And I feel like that was one of the first ones to really break out of that mold. And say,
well, and we'll talk about it when we treat it on autopilot, but It's Gary Shandling's show was almost a parody of a talk show, but it actually had Gary Shandling hosting it.
Right.
The Larry Sanders Show just took it that other step and was like, okay, now he's going to be hosting a talk show, but playing somebody else.
Right.
And so it's just going to be a real show.
If I was to compare it to something current, I'd say it feels a lot like, if my memory's right, it feels a lot like, Larry David show. Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Has a definitely tonal kind of thing going on there. So anyway, that'll be next month, a month from now-ish, in the month of August, we will tackle the Larry Sanders Show.
In the dog days of August,
indeed,
we will tackle John Wick.
And next week is, that should be in the top 200. John Wick's an amazing movie. It never will be, but it should. It's too many movies now. Like, it's too crowded. How are you going
to
get...
We need to cut down on the movies.
Yeah. We get rid of a few so that we can narrow
the
our
movie
list.
Glut.
But anyway, after this, when this episode ends, stick around because the legal geeks here, excuse me, to talk about the legacy of Anthony Kennedy as he retires from the Supreme Court after 30 years of service. Legal Geek always bringing a fun little nerd twist to such proceedings. So check that out right after this. And next week, Normal Current Geek. Everything should go fine there. If you want to support us on Patreon, there's a great way to do it. It's so simple it hurts. Go over to patreon.com/currentgeek and jump on the wagon, everybody. Be a part of the love train. I can't think of any more things to say about
people all over the world.
There you go.
Give us a dollar.
Nailed it. And if you did too, that'd be awesome. So go check it out. Consider it. We'd love it. Patreon.com/currentgeek. Tom, before we go, anything you would like to mention before we go?
Oh, yeah. I've got a new book out called Gallium. Mm. It is a science fiction adventure about a salvager who finds a historical thing that people don't want her to reveal, and they try to stop her. It takes place in a solar system far away, but in the same universe as Lot Beta. That sounds intriguing. You can find out more at TomMerrittBooks.com.
That sounds fantastic. What else? That's it. CurrentGeek.com is the website. Head on over there and check us out. If you have some thoughts and feelings, you can leave comments there or send us emails. It's all linked right there on the page. FrogPants.com/CurrentGeek or CurrentGeek.com. Either way, it'll get you there. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we take a look at the 30-year history of Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court as he steps aside to retire following this past term. Unlike many justices, including Justice Scalia, who we profiled a couple years ago, Kennedy will go down in history as a critical swing vote who truly charted the course of many major decisions as the law has developed in the courts over the past three decades. But let's start at the beginning, which was an interesting circumstance for how Kennedy even ended up on this court. Kennedy was a graduate of Stanford University and Harvard Law School, and after a few years in private law practice, he was appointed to serve as a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in his home state of California. About a decade later, he was nominated by President Reagan in 1987 to be the third choice to fill a seat on the Supreme Court, after the first two nominees, Robert Bork and Douglas Ginsburg, were voted down and withdrew from consideration. He was such a better nominee than those peers that he sailed through confirmation with a 97-0 vote at the Senate. So this bit of a happy accident led to what became a 30-year run on the highest court in the land. Kennedy was fairly conservative in his views overall, and sided with those judges more than with liberal judges. But he had many libertarian beliefs that would cause him to sometimes disagree with his fellow conservatives, or moderate their opinions. This led to him being a swing vote for much of his career at the court, and involvement in many critical and historic decisions of the court. For example, Kennedy was in the majority in 5-4 opinions 346 times during his tenure, compared to being in the minority of a 5-4 decision only 126 times. Some of his most important decisions include co-authoring the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision in 1992 that affirmed Roe v. Wade and the right to have abortions. Kennedy was also the deciding vote in the Bush v. Gore 2000 case that ended the recount and effectively awarded the presidency officially to George W. Bush. Another important opinion by Kennedy was in Roper v. Simmons, which outlawed as unconstitutional the death penalty for crimes committed before the defendant turns 18. While all of these were seminal and important moments where Kennedy spoke on behalf of a 5-4 split in the court, his primary legacy will be in two areas, LGBT rights and First Amendment protections. This makes sense, as his libertarian views often put him right in the middle on these types of issues, and he was able to craft quite a legacy in both areas. Relative to LGBT rights, his first major opinion was in the mid-90s in a case called Romer v. Evans, in which the court struck down a Colorado constitutional amendment that denied protected class status to LGBT individuals. In 2003, he authored the court's opinion in Lawrence v. Texas, finding that a Texas law prohibiting sodomy was unconstitutional. Then, he made an even bolder move in the 2013 U.S. v. Windsor case, where he held the Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage as only between a man and a woman, as unconstitutional. That led to his crowning achievement 2 years later in the 2015 Obergefell v. Hodges decision that recognized a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. Under Kennedy's tenure, the court went from stopping outright discrimination laws against LGBT to recognizing fundamental rights of those same people. Perhaps an even greater legacy will be left in the First Amendment practice, where Kennedy was always expansive in his readings of the protections offered by this constitutional amendment. Almost every year, Kennedy drafted one or more opinions based on his views of the First Amendment, including the recent Trump v. Hawaii case that we covered last week. Last year, he authored the Mattal v. Tam trademark case that removed the Lanham Act's ban on disparaging trademarks as being improper viewpoint discrimination by the government under the First Amendment. Most notable in this field was the 2010 decision in Citizens United v. Federal Elections Commission, which freed corporations and unions from the limits previously applied to how much money these organizations can spend on political advertising. And this First Amendment philosophy was exactly what made the recent Colorado Baker case so interesting, as it put an LGBT couple's rights against a First Amendment claim being made by the baker who refused to bake the cake. Kennedy found a way to avoid the conflict between his two judicial beliefs by deciding that case on mostly procedural grounds, avoiding the First Amendment implications that would have perhaps undercut some of his work in expanding LGBT rights. It really makes for a fitting end for both parts of the primary legacy Kennedy leaves from his 30 years on the Supreme Court. The bottom line is, Anthony Kennedy may go down as one of, if not the most influential and important justice of this era. His unique views compared to his fellow justices allowed moderation and compromise, as both sides always needed to seek Kennedy's support to win the day. It will likely be impossible to replace Kennedy with someone truly similar, so we will turn our attention to what the court will begin to look like in our next segment. Until then, we salute Justice Anthony Kennedy for his long outstanding service to the country and his additions to the jurisprudence of this nation. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.